goal, his mission to forge closer military ties with China and to assess the U.S. role in some of the region's most pressing security issues. Joining me in the studio to talk about the challenges for Secretary Gates, David Shambaugh. He's director of the China Policy Program at George Washington University. Good morning to you, sir.
Good morning, Diane.
Nice to have you here. Michael Green, he's at the Center for Strategic and International Studies and at Georgetown University. Good morning.
Good morning.
And joining us from an NPR studio in New York, John Delurie of the Asia Society Center on U.S.-China Relations and professor at Yonsei University Graduate School of International Studies in Seoul. Good morning to you, sir.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for being with us. And throughout the hour, we'll welcome your calls. Join us on 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. Join us on Facebook or Twitter. Let's start with China. David Shambaugh, how successful has Secretary Gates' trip been toward forging better relations with China?
Well, he went to Beijing to forge, first of all, military relations with China. And forging any military relations with China has to be considered a success because they've been suspended for more than a year by the Chinese side, I might add, in response to American sales of $6.4 billion worth of weapons to Taiwan last January. So we've had a year of no military exchanges between the United States and China. So this is a significant trip in that regard, just to restart them. And one of the things they did, in fact, was to set out a calendar of exchanges over the next 12 months. So there's a roadmap for the future. There are a couple of other things I think we have to put in the accomplishment category. First of all, just to visit the 2nd Artillery Headquarters, it's called, which is China's nuclear weapons command complex. This is the, I think, second time that an American defense secretary has been taken to that facility. Don Rumsfeld was taken there previously. Gates might have actually gone there once before. Anyway, that's sort of an effort on the Chinese to be more transparent about nuclear policy. And then from what we can tell from the press and the press conferences that were given, the discussions with the Chinese military and civilian leadership, including President Hu Jintao, went fairly well, certainly as well as could be expected, on a whole variety of issues. The one thing that seems, well, two things that sort of in the negative category that have arisen. One was Gates's proposal to the Chinese to start a dialogue on four very sensitive areas: missile defense, cybersecurity, space security, and nuclear weapons strategy. The Chinese said they will study that proposal. The American media considered that a rebuff. I'm not so sure it's a rebuff. I think it means they will study it and hopefully take it up. The other big thing that's gotten a lot of press, of course, is the test flight of the new Chinese stealth fighter, the J-20, precisely on the day he was meeting with the Chinese president. Coincidental, not coincidental, we're not quite sure. The Chinese president told Gates he didn't know about it, in fact. And I think, and Gates himself said he takes the president at his word. So we don't know. But that was a demonstration of, in the Air Force domain, how far the Chinese military modernization is actually moving. But on balance, I think, Diane, we have to say the Gates trip was quite successful.
And Michael Green, would you agree? And what about that test flight in front of Secretary Gates?
Well, at first, I'd agree with David. On balance, it was a successful trip and accomplished as much as could realistically be expected given the Chinese military, the PLA's resistance to transparency with the U.S. How long this will last is another question. They've cut these military dialogues off a number of times when frustrated with us for usually for Taiwan-related issues. I think the trip also highlighted for the American public concerns that are growing within the administration about what should be called civil-military relations. Hu Jintao probably was surprised that the Chinese military tested during the, you know, Gates' visit and just before his visit with the Chinese president, this new weapon.
Could he really have been surprised? And if he was, what does that say about the relationship between the military and the president?
I personally, we don't know, but I think Secretary Gates' instincts was right that he was surprised. I worked for President Bush as his Asia advisor and traveled with him and with Secretary of State Powell and others to China. And this kind of thing happened before. We met Jiang Zemin in 2002. There was an earthquake that morning. Hundreds of people were killed, and he didn't know about it. So the Chinese president is clearly not briefed in the way the American president is every morning about national security. He's chair of the Central Military Commission. The party controls the military in that sense, but it doesn't have the kind of day-to-day operational oversight. There's no civilian bureaucracy. There are no congressional committees. And so information, especially about operations, is controlled basically by the PLA. And this is, I think, a growing source of concern, particularly as PLA generals become more outspoken on foreign policy and begin to cast China's image differently around the world.
And John DeLurie, do you want to weigh in?
Well, David and Michael are covering the key points. It is interesting. There's a great deal of speculation about this question, could he really not have known, and what are the implications of that? And as two others can comment, there has been, China experts have been increasingly wondering what is the emerging sort of foreign policy role of the PLA. So you could conceivably put this as a data point in that analysis. But I think probably most people would agree it would be stepping way too far out to think that the PLA, ordered this strategically to time without telling Hu Jintao, to make some point. For me, I think that's really pushing it too far to go to that.
John DeLurie, a new Pew Research poll finds that for the first time, most Americans believe that Asia rather than Europe is the most important region to U.S. interests. Would you agree?
Well, that's why I moved over to Korea and I'm teaching there. I'm kidding. No, there is this, it's everywhere. I mean, we're surrounded by rising China and certainly coming out of the economic crisis insofar as we are. The East Asian economies, well, especially China and South Korea has done well, have recovered at least superficially, survived the crisis and have recovered much more quickly. So that's also generating this impression. But, these opinion polls shift quickly, so we can't put too much weight into them.
Now, David Chamba, the president of China, is coming here next week. In light of Secretary Gates' visit to China, how might that affect what happens between President Obama and Hu Jintao?
Well, indeed, Diane, President Hu Jintao will visit the White House next Wednesday, I believe the 19th of January, for a full state visit, including a banquet, state dinner, 21-gun South Lawn salute, and welcoming ceremony. This is all the bells and all the whistles. This is a big deal. And any time the two presidents of the People's Republic of China and the United States meet, it's a big deal. They meet frequently, I should say. This will be the eighth meeting between the two in 2 years. But a state visit is different than meeting on the sides of another international conference, which they tend to do. So this in itself is a very important event, and we maybe should talk a bit more about that. But your question about the Gates visit relative to the Hu visit, the Gates visit is one more step in the last 2 months that both sides have been trying to prepare for the Hu visit, to set the atmospherics, I think. We've had a meeting in December in the commercial realm, what's called the Joint Commission on Commerce and Trade. We had a defense consultation talks in December. We've had meetings between other parts of the two governments over the last 8 weeks to try and prepare a better atmosphere. Why? Because the atmosphere for the previous 12 months was terrible. This has been the worst year. Last year was the worst year in U.S.-China relations.
Why?
Oh, gosh. The relationship started to unravel and unhinge and hemorrhage, I would say, beginning with President Obama's state visit to China in November of 2009. From then until this November, we saw one thing after another. Started with the Copenhagen Climate Change Conference, then went to the Google issue, then it went to the American arms sales to Taiwan, then Obama's meeting to the Dalai Lama, then the imprisonment of Liu Xiaobo, now the Nobel Peace Prize winner for 11 years. The human rights situation in China deteriorated. Whole series of economic issues between the two sides, on both sides, investment issues, trade issues, the currency issue, one thing after another. It was a terrible year in U.S.-China relations.
So do you see things on the improvement scale?
Well, David's absolutely right. This was a very rough year. I think it's against the backdrop of the financial crisis, which, rightly or wrongly, looked in China like the beginning of American pronounced decline. I think they now realize wrongly. And a leadership transition in China in 2012. So in effect, Hu Jintao is a lame duck. And much like politics in other countries, these transitions bring out a lot of competition, nationalism, posturing. But this summit will, I think, reestablish some stability. No doubt about it. It's critical for that. Will it fix the various problems in U.S.-China relations? No. It won't. Those will remain. But at least it will put a floor under the problem, and maybe we'll have a better year next year.
Michael Green, he's Japan Chair, Senior Advisor at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. He's also Associate Professor in International Relations at Georgetown University. We'll take just a short break and be right back.
More Diane Reims Sunday is just ahead here on WAMU 88.5. Good afternoon. I'm Elliot Francis.
WAMU 88.5 brings nourishing programs to you every day. And the WAMU member card brings hundreds of nourishing two-for-one dining opportunities. Visit WAMU.org for details.
This program of the Diane Reims Show was recorded earlier, so we're not able to take new phone calls. But we welcome your comments at drshow.org or join us on Facebook.
And we're back talking about Defense Secretary Gates' trip to East Asia, what progress or otherwise he may have made with the Chinese, with Japan, with South Korea. And indeed, we have three guests with us. Michael Green is at the Center for Strategic and International Studies, on the line with us from an NPR studio in New York is John DeLury, Senior Fellow at the Asian Society Center on U.S.-China Relations. He's Professor at Yonsei University Graduate School of International Studies in Seoul, and David Chamba, Professor of Political Science and International Affairs at George Washington University. His newest book is China's Communist Party, Atrophy and Adaptation. We will take your call shortly. Feel free to join us. I want to turn to you now, Michael Green, on Japan. The United States wants to have Japan establish stronger military ties with South Korea, but what are Japan's military capabilities?
Well, Japan is now ranked the third largest economy in the world, and per capita spending on defense is around 124. But when you have an economy that large, even if you're spending, you know, less than 1% of your economic product on defense, that's a lot of firepower. So Japan has one of the largest navies in the world, one of the largest air forces. But their constitution outlaws basically the right of war, so it's been they've been prescribed in what they can do. They've also had a difficult relationship with Korea, another American ally, but a country Japan occupied and in many ways repressed for decades in the 19th and 20th centuries. So, in other words, Japan has enormous capabilities, but has been very constrained in how it's used.
Right.
So what the U.S., I think, would like, Japan's economy is in trouble like ours, and a big increase in defense spending is probably not going to happen. But I think that Secretary Gates would like Japan to use what it has more ambitiously, not for war, but for humanitarian relief, for peacekeeping, for patrolling Japan's sea lanes, and also for Korea and Japan to work more closely together now. Because they both face a common threat from North Korea, which is very clear. And although they have somewhat different views of China, in both Korea and Japan, there is Japan more than Korea. But in both countries now, there's growing alarm about what China's long-term intentions are. And clearly in both countries, a recognition once again how critical the U.S. alliance and forward presence is. So there's something of a convergence, despite many historical difficulties, between Japan and Korea. It's in U.S. interests and has always been so for those two allies to work together to stabilize the region.
And John DeLury, what would North Korea's reaction be should Japan begin to patrol those sea lanes? What would that raise in the minds of North Korea?
Well, rhetorically, there'd be fire and brimstone coming out of Pyongyang, and indeed, it wouldn't be surprising to see a new sphere of maritime conflict. You know, as we all know, there's been really dramatic and horrific conflict on the sea border between the two Koreas on the west side, on the West Sea. And historically, there have been issues on the other side. So if you saw an increase in activity there, North Korea would certainly perceive it, you know, as a security threat, and it would not at all be surprising to see, again, a new sphere of conflict out there.
And indeed, Secretary Gates speculated recently that within 5 years, North Korea could have a missile capable of hitting the United States. How widely is that view held in the region, John DeLury?
Well, you know, it's assumed he has access to, you know, the best intelligence the United States can muster, and that he's not going to come out publicly and make a comment like that unless it's grounded in some really solid findings and assessment. Certainly, you know, there's been regular missile testing of short and mid and long-range tests. They haven't all gone successfully, but, you know, North Korea has a very active missile program. I mean, there's a whole other issue with making that a nuclear-capable long-range missile, and that involves what I understand to be a much more complicated process of miniaturizing a nuclear warhead that you could attach to a missile. So you have to be careful to separate those two things. But of course, you know, when the Secretary of Defense of the United States comes out and gives such a hard number of 5 years, that's something you have to pay attention to, and people in the region are.
But David Chamba, the main player here is China, and the U.S. is asking China for assistance with North Korea on issues like these missiles?
That's right. You know, if North Korea is the great enigma on the planet, China's relationship with North Korea is even a greater enigma. nobody really understands it. Of course, as you say, Diane, the United States would like and has sought for many years, including during the Bush administration when Mike Green was working in the White House, to elicit Beijing's assistance on a range of issues dealing with North Korea, not just the nuclear issue. But Beijing's calculation towards North Korea is very different than our own. They don't start with nuclear weapons. That is a concern of theirs. They don't want the North to have nuclear weapons, and they want a denuclearized Korean Peninsula, but that's not the primary issue to them. The primary issue to them is the sustenance of the North Korean regime. They don't want an implosion and collapse of this state and this country on their border, both for practical reasons, because of the refugee flow that would result, because of the reconstruction needs that would make the reconstruction of East Germany, for example, pale in comparison, but because of their own, I would argue, domestic political insecurities. If a communist regime on their periphery collapsed, it might accentuate their Chinese Communist Party's own insecurities about their own rule. So there's a variety of issues in the way that Beijing looks at North Korea that do not begin with nuclear weapons. And that's part of part of the problem with Washington.
John DeLury, what kind of unilateral pressure, though, is each of these countries, Japan, the United States, China, what sort of multilateral pressure can be put on the North Koreans?
Well, as David says, there's some fundamental differences in how China views this and acts on it than the United States, and I don't expect that to go away. There may be some efforts to paper it over between Obama and Hu Jintao, but there's this really fundamental difference, both in terms of the priorities and then also the methods that the two sides think are most effective with North Korea. You know, in my view, China is going to be consistent in the policy they've had, which is to keep channels open with Pyongyang, diplomatic and economic. They're always chipping away at getting North Korea to follow the Chinese path to no success thus far, but they always chip away at it. You know, the United States right now is aligned, especially really with South Korea. I mean, the current policy really started from a switch in the South Korean government and South Korean approach to North Korea, which is, you know, officially a dual track, but in fact, it's been emphasis on sanctions, on containment, and not being very eager to jump in there and get to the negotiating table with North Korea. So South Korea, Japan, and the United States have maintained more or less a shared approach on that. You know, and Michael should comment, especially on Japan. Very recently, there have been these signals of potentially all three sides opening up, even some bilateral channels. Japan, even the foreign minister came out and floated that. And there's been some activity both in Seoul and in Washington suggesting that. But it's very tentative on these sides, whereas the Chinese are, you know, they're in there and they're going to keep talking to Pyongyang and to wait for China to finally toughen up and cut off the fuel and other aid to the North, I think is really waiting for Godot.
Michael Green.
Well, I think the administration hopes on this trip, and they may succeed, although it's a little bit of a long shot, to convince President Hu and the Chinese leadership that they have to think differently about North Korea. And David described exactly how they think about North Korea: stability first. And the message from Washington has been, and I think in the summit will be, the mounting of nuclear warheads on missiles is not that far away. And when that happens, North Korea becomes not a proliferation concern or a security tension. North Korea, it becomes a fundamental threat to the security of the United States and Japan and South Korea. And therefore, we are going to tighten our security cooperation, increase our military presence. It's a high-stakes game, and it's a tough message to the Chinese. And I think the administration feels that they're getting a little bit of traction. But whether or not it knocks China off its current stance, which John and David described absolutely right, we'll see. I'm not sure whether the Chinese calculation is immutable and permanent, and they're going to test that. I think North Korea will be actually at the top of the agenda for this summit.
Interesting. Here are two messages for us on Facebook. The first from Perry, who says, "I think we should speak past the current government to the Chinese people, stand up for our values, protect our intellectual property, encourage U.S. companies to reject one-way deals which give Chinese entities 51% ownership and transfer intellectual property." David Chamba.
Well, he makes some good points. There have been longstanding concerns about Chinese forced transfer of technologies as part of so-called joint ventures. Whether you have 51% or 49% ownership, nonetheless, it is a joint venture. But what China has done, not so much with American companies, actually, more with European and even Asian companies, is to leverage that and make the terms of the contract involve transfer of actual technologies and a lot of training, which they then pirate and clone and integrate into subsequent systems of their own. So I think the caller, the writer of the email, has a good point there. But there are mechanisms to deal with this, bilateral and multilateral, through the World Trade Organization. Our government, in fact, Secretary Geithner gave this very important speech at his alma mater yesterday at Johns Hopkins SAIS, on which he spoke directly to this point. And the U.S. government's getting a bit tougher, in fact, on this issue with the Chinese, and it's about time, frankly. The European Union is trying to be tougher with the Chinese on this, and it's about time. So we'll see if the Chinese actually do respond on the so-called indigenous innovation issue.
David Chamba of George Washington University, and you're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. But on the first part of Perry's point, how do we speak beyond the government of China to the people themselves? Is that even a real possibility, Michael Green?
Yes and no. I think David probably has also had the experience of appearing on Phoenix TV based out of Hong Kong, or the American Radio Free Asia and other broadcasts, and you'll reach 5 to 10 to 15 million Chinese, which sounds pretty impressive until you remember there are 1.3 billion Chinese. So it's a mixed picture. The internet, as David has written, provides some access to information, but it's also controlled. I think, though, the caller makes a point about the Chinese people versus the Chinese leadership. One of the things about this visit that has, to my mind, received surprisingly little attention is the fact that President Obama, a Nobel Peace Prize laureate, will be having the full honors of a state visit with a leader who is imprisoning another Nobel Peace Prize laureate, Liu Xiaobo. And the media has been pretty quiet on that. And even in the Pew polling, the American public is, less concerned with those issues than they used to be. It probably reflects our economic challenges. But all the small progress that we've talked about in with Gates' visit and so forth in the lead up to the summit is good. But on human rights, this summit is actually kind of unique in that we've accomplished nothing. I mean, a few years ago, Liu Xiaobo or others might have been released before a summit. What's really striking to me is how the Chinese leadership just doesn't care or is unable to respond to international and American concerns about these kinds of issues.
And here's another message posted on Facebook by Andrew, who says the Chinese are expanding their military. The North Koreans are a nuclear-capable power with dubious leadership, but the real problem is the economic war that China seems to be waging against us, one in which we can be destroyed from within our own country. David Chamba.
I think that's a bit extreme, to be honest with you. It's a zero-sum perspective. There's no economic war going on, in my view, between the U.S. and China, or China and any other country. Economics in today's globalized world are inherently interdependent. We're joined at the hip, for better or for worse, with the Chinese economy. They may own a lot of our debt, but they're also extremely dependent on us as their primary market, or secondary market, actually. They export more to the European Union than they do to the United States. But I don't think we need to look at the Sino-American economic relationship through a zero-sum lens, but we've got problems. I think the writer is very correct there. We've got to negotiate those very toughly, but it's not quite as severe as he puts it.
I thought it was interesting that Secretary of the Treasury Geithner said yesterday, talking about the yuan and his hopes for a more devaluation of the yuan, that ultimately, our economic success depends on us and getting the deficit down, getting our economic house in order. So I think that would support what you say, Michael Green.
Well, sometimes, the American political system can really be motivated when they're a little bit scared of someone else's success. And that is a critical part of it. The foundation of our power does rest on our economic strength. I think that the interesting thing about the Chinese perspective on U.S. power is that commentators who say we're declining are usually not the economists. It's the PLA officers or the netizens. And I think that fundamentally there's a recognition in the leadership, and especially in places like Japan and Korea and elsewhere, that there's a lot of resilience in the American economy and the American political system. And one of the things over the past year that the administration has done quite effectively, I think, is to show the rest of Asia after the financial crisis the depth of our real power, our relationships, our military, and our economy. The administration was quite reticent on trade policy initially, but this past year has reached agreements with Korea on a free trade, has begun negotiations with other countries, and I think that has really built confidence in us in the region.
Michael Green, he's at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. He's also Associate Professor in International Relations at Georgetown University. When we come back, we'll open the phones. I look forward to hearing from you.
National broadcast of the Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, helping NPR advance journalistic excellence in the digital age. By MetLife Foundation, committed to promoting healthy families and good nutrition, on the web at MetLife.org. By the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, and by the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, supporting unconventional approaches to transform health and health care, at rwjf.org/pioneer. This is NPR.
Hi, it's Diane Rehm. The newspaper business has been romanticized in many books and movies, but not in the novel we've chosen for this month's Reader's Review. The Imperfectionist by Tom Rackman follows the lives of journalists at a struggling international paper as the era of print teeters on the edge. I hope you'll join me for that discussion January 19th. And as we talk about East Asia, Secretary of Defense Gates' visit to East Asia, let's go to Fort Lauderdale, Florida. Good morning, Eddie. You're on the air.
Hello?
Hi. Go right ahead.
Hi. Good morning. Diane, I'm sorry, but I got to say this. I want the world to know, don't forget about Haiti. This is not over. I'm from Haiti. I just wanted to say that. I know this is off topic. I wanted to say that out there. And I have a question and a point to make. My question is, why are we so afraid of China getting a stealth bomber? Are we afraid that they're going to attack us here? And my point is, when I was a child, I used to hear great stories about America, how great America is. And now when you go around the world, you had people making fun how much of a joke we are. We have no more power of doing anything. It's not like we're going to change anything out there. Why are we so afraid?
David Chemba.
I don't think we're afraid of a Chinese stealth bomber attacking the continental United States. Perhaps worst case scenario, we involved ourselves in a conflict in East Asia with China, that such a bomber or fighter might come into play. But the last fighter that the Chinese have now in their force, the J-10, this one they just tested is going to be the successor. It took over 20 years to get that plane from the design table into production, so to speak. So a test flight of this new plane, I think, is a long, long way away from putting it into the Chinese Air Force, first of all. Secondly, where is it going to fly to? The Chinese don't have any bases outside their own country, and their in-flight refueling capability is a bit dubious. So I don't think we need to concern ourselves too much about it.
Here's an email from Bill, who says, isn't it in China's interest to see the slow demise of the U.S. and to the extent that North Korea can consume U.S. resources, political, capital, financial, wouldn't this work to China's benefit? Short of U.S. action that causes North Korea to collapse, I see no reason why China would want to diffuse the tension between the U.S. and North Korea. John DeLurie.
Well, that's a devious suggestion. I think Bill's maybe reading The Art of War by Sun Tzu. I mean, there is, you know, without getting conspiratorial about it, I think Bill's onto something. Just in point of fact, North Korea does consume and absorb a huge amount of American resources, and it is a constant source of distraction. And there is some degree to which that does play to the Chinese hand. So I don't know that you know, it's their strategy to actively create that situation or maintain it. But I think there's some truth just to the reality of things. One thing I want to step back and comment on pretty
sure.
much in all the comments of these callers is quite interesting. The worries about Chinese, you know, buying 51% of American companies, the worries about Chinese military expansion. You know, one thing that we should reflect on is what would the Diane Rehm Show discussion be like if we held it in China in Chinese? And, you know, while there is control, there's internet control, there is also a great deal of increased openness on the media so that, you know, certainly on blogs and BBS boards, you have those kinds of open discussions. Not the same, but certainly relative to the past for China. And, you know, one thing we would hear listening to that, we do hear listening to those conversations, is a lot of these same anxieties and fears that Chinese have across different demographics about the United States and its intentions towards China and whether the United States is really going to make room for China, you know, and in terms of all the conflicts that occurred over the last year, whether it's Taiwan, whether it's the Dalai Lama, whether it's the issues, you know, with North Korea. There are very common views held in China that the United States is pursuing this long-term strategy of containment, of holding back China. So that's something for the American public to be aware of, you know, that there's a real mirror image here in a lot of these anxieties.
And John DeLurie, do you believe that the Chinese government would allow the Diane Rehm Show to broadcast in China?
I think we should definitely arrange to talk to the right people in China and get you over there and host it. You know, again, the media world in China is one of those places where you can find openings that surprise you. Now, there are lots of examples, very bad examples, in the human rights situation overall. There's no question it's trending negatively. But media is one place where you can, like I think it was Michael referenced Phoenix TV or others, you can find these holes that you can exploit where you can do things that would be surprising.
Interesting. David.
Well, I just came back from spending a year in China on a sabbatical and spent a good part of that year talking to Chinese journalists, both television, radio, and print. Went into a number of TV and radio studios like this and had, as John just suggested, some pretty straightforward discussions that were not censored. I remember sitting in a studio with a Chinese general, for example, for an hour on TV talking about the Chinese military capabilities, and they didn't censor that. But in print, they do censor frequently. I mean, I've had innumerable.
Interesting that there should be that difference between print and broadcast.
Well, it's difficult to delete certain sentences from a television broadcast.
But why would they allow that to go forward in the first place?
Well, good question. But they in this case, they did. And I thought it was important enough to go on the program and try and address how the outside world sees the Chinese military. But John's right. The Chinese media is quite open, but we shouldn't forget there's still extreme censorship. I've had my own articles censored repeatedly. I just submitted one today that's going to run tomorrow in a Beijing newspaper. And we'll see
what it looks
comes
like.
Out.
Yeah.
That's right.
And to follow up on John DeLurie's comment, Angie in Jacksonville, Florida, you're on the air.
Hi, Diane. Thank you for letting me on the show.
Sure.
I wanted to ask your panel, what is the problem with us in America? Because we are always thinking of bilateral relationships that we have with other countries, but we forget that it is a bilateral relationship. That means when we are asking the Chinese to open their military facilities to us, do we at the same time open our own facilities to them? We are asking Chinese to lower their currency, to higher their currency, or do what, whatever. Are we at the same time doing the same thing for them or giving in to their own requests. Because if we don't do that, we're going to be seen as bully, as we are often seen in many places in the world.
Thanks for your call, Angie. Michael Green.
Well, on the specific point that Angie made about military tours and openness, the U.S. Military, the Pentagon, views transparency as important and not threatening to us. Secretary Rumsfeld briefly had a different view, but for most of our history...
Not so briefly, I would say.
Well, on the China-U.S. military-to-military relationship, Secretary Rumsfeld was very skeptical, but that was the exception. Secretary Gates and others on the Pentagon side, and certainly the presidents from Clinton through Bush to Obama, have viewed military-to-military transparency as in our interests. Why? Because we're stronger, frankly. And it helps to dissuade China from being too militarily ambitious. And because we have a more open and transparent system to begin with, we want to demonstrate to China how you show this transparency. So we're actually quite generous compared to the PLA on that front. On other issues like economics, these are negotiations, and they're very tough. And I've been in them. And both sides, make their cases. Both sides make concessions. I don't think anybody would argue we're pushing China around in these negotiations. They're tough, and both sides have their agenda, and we work it.
All right, to Boston, Massachusetts. Good morning, Hank. You're on the air.
Hello. Oh, hi, Hank.
Yes.
Oh, yeah. Diane, you are wonderful. Oh, I love to hear your voice.
Thank you.
You are my heroine. Now, the major message I want to say is that I ought to say, number one, if our incentive is try to make China to be good, instead of punish them, instead of degrade them, instead of using force, we should encourage them. I can tell you, if we respect Chinese, China, one inch. China, we respect you and nice to you for miles, miles, miles. And what I really want to say is that look at all the Chinese scientists coming to America. They help USA discover drug and discover this and that. They never cause trouble, right? Now, if we can turn China to be good, and I think if we can understand the West and the East turn the competitor to be collaborator, and China can help USA a lot.
Michael Green.
Well, American presidents since Richard Nixon have been quite encouraging to China. And China policy is one of the prominent areas in American foreign policy where there's a pretty strong bipartisan consensus. And American presidents have told their counterparts publicly and privately they want to see China play a larger role. They want a cooperative and productive relationship with China. And at the same time, issues of human rights, trade, the PLA military buildup are going to be obstacles to that, and we need to work on them. And that's been pretty consistent over 30-some years.
David Chamba.
I agree with Mike. For 30 years, we have been encouraging China to integrate peacefully into the international system, have a stake in that system, treat its own people in a more humane way, liberalize its own...
Of course, we've been telling them how, have we not? We've been saying, do it our way.
No, I wouldn't quite say that. We've been saying there is an international standard, and these standards are enforced by international organizations and norms and laws, and we would expect as a member of the international community China to be a global citizen. And our government has been encouraging for 6, 7, 8 consecutive administrations China to obey the norms and laws of the international system. So I think the caller is right. We've been encouraging that. The question is, does China see it in their own interests to integrate that way and to obey the international norms when they were not at the table when those norms were written? So they feel that they're being asked to join a system, in fact, that they themselves didn't have much input into 40 years ago.
John DeLury, what about that East-West culture clash?
Well, I appreciate the spirit of the caller's remarks, but I have to say, if we go back to one of the earlier issues raised by your listeners about values and dealing with human rights and values, You know, my sense is that the Obama administration and Secretary Clinton made a calculation that made a lot of sense at that time, that, you know, this approach of getting in China's face over the values issues and human rights, it doesn't work. And you just get these occasional piecemeal improvements of you know, releasing a dissident before a meeting, but that this administration was going to try and engage China at a deeper level, and, you know, not kind of pull out, you know, air the bad the dirty laundry, but find a way to talk to the Chinese government in a way that it wouldn't lose any face, but that they could raise these issues. And, you know, so far, what we're seeing is that's not getting many results. And I think the Obama government already has recognized that and has turned a corner and has been more confrontational, for lack of a better word. And I think, frankly, that you have to be, especially on the issue of values and human rights. You know, I mean, Obama came in just in a domestic context, rightfully, of the way he was trying to sort of redeem America internationally, was by improving our own values, you know, with issues like Guantanamo and others. And we still have a long way to go on that. But, you know, I think we've made enough progress, and the country and the government does stand for values that we should defend, and I think really have to, you know, with China. So I think, you know, as Michael said, I think it should get back into the playbook to pressure for the release of a dissident, or you know, that level of activity before a summit. You know, and it didn't happen when Obama went to Beijing, and it's not happening this time. We'll see if there's anything at all with Liu Xiaobo. So far, there's been very little. And I think we have to, you know, the American government really should turn up the heat on that.
John DeLurie, he's senior fellow at the Asia Society Center on U.S.-China Relations. You're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. And here's an email from Marion, who says, Chinese and Japanese relations, traditionally chilly, and particularly so since the last Japanese invasion of China, will have to be one of trust but verify. I do not see these two countries as ever moving close politically. I believe a cautious peace can be maintained by the two. Michael Green.
Sounds about right to me. The strange thing about China's relations with its neighbors right now is that China is the largest trading partner for Japan, Korea, Australia, heading there with India. And for all of this economic interdependence, has China won the trust of its neighbors? No. On the security side, the trend's gone in the opposite direction. 89% of Japanese say they don't trust China, over 60% of Koreans. And the numbers across Asia about China are much more negative than in the United States. And so one of the things that's shaping the U.S.-China relationship is that the rest of Asia, especially these middle powers and large powers like Japan, India, Korea, Indonesia, are worried about China and are pulling the U.S. into Asia, want us to stay, want to have closer relations. And that's shaping the overall U.S.-China relationship in ways that, frankly, I think help us get through to Beijing about the importance of global norms.
David Chamba, last word.
I completely agree with Mike.
And do you both, do you all believe that this state visit will help to improve relations between the U.S. and China, David?
I think it'll help to stabilize the relationship, which, as I said at the outset, has been hemorrhaging and in deterioration over the last year. So it will provide a floor to that, and hopefully in certain areas forge cooperation. If we can do that and particularly put in place some bureaucratic mechanisms to forge cooperation, then it can be successful. Otherwise, it's going to be a lot of symbols of symmetry without a lot of substance.
David Chamba, Michael Green, John DeLurie, thank you all so much. And thanks for listening, everybody. I'm Diane Rehm.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkard, Nancy Robertson, Susan Neighbors, Denise Couture, and Monique Nazareth. The engineer is Toby Schreiner. Dori Annisman answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives, transcripts, podcasts, and CD sales. Call 202-885-1200 for more information. Our email address is drshow@wamu.org, and we're on Facebook and Twitter. Twitter. This program comes to you from American University in Washington. This is NPR.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from Progressive Insurance, helping people shop for car insurance at 1-800-PROGRESSIVE and progressive.com. From CSX, working to reduce traffic and pollution while moving 1 million tons of freight daily. CSX, how tomorrow moves. And from Constant Contact, offering tools to manage, monitor, and measure social media. Learn more at constantcontact.com/social media. This is NPR.
Welcome to The Global Guru. I'm Rachel Louise Snyder. Each week we ask one simple question, just one, about somewhere in the world. Today we're in Cuba asking, what's our destiny?
We are born, each of us born, with a particular destiny in life. But one of the tricks that El Egua does is he makes us forget our destiny on our way over to this world.
El Egua is sneaky that way. Or so I've learned from
Frank Babajobe.
Frank explains.
Babajobe is my sign as a Baba Lao, which is a high priest in the Santeria religion. Baba Lao means father of the secrets.
He won't spill his secrets, but he is teaching me about the Orishas of Santeria, Cuba's second most prevalent religion after Catholicism.
Above everything, you have Olodumare, but Olodumare is very distant. So we deal with much more local emissaries or representatives that we call Orishas.
Frank says Orishas are forces of nature and all human endeavor. There are 400 of them, though only about 20 who are called to action on a regular basis. He tells me about a few.
And Orisha like Ochun, she's the river. She owns everything that's sweet in the world. She's the Orisha of love. Each of the Orishas we go to for specific reasons.
Like Chungo, the partier.
The Orisha of fire, of lightning. He's Orisha of drumming. He's a bit of a womanizer. Also very passionate and extremely powerful warrior.
El Egua is also one to look out for, Frank says. Remember him? The destiny dude?
He opens and closes the doors and roads to life to all of us. He's the Orisha of the crossroads, where we could go in any direction. El Egua can be very tricky. He's old and young at the same time. He's an Orisha of contradictions.
He's the messenger who brings our souls to the world. But en route, we forget our destinies.
We spend a lot of our lives undoing ourselves, working against our destinies.